Good morning and welcome to Countrywide. Coming up before nine, Trump's tariffs. What's the impact on agricultural exports to the US? Two new donkey foals are born in Clifton, and farmers step up to protect the corn crake on Inishbofin. 51551 for texts, email countrywide@rte.ie. Well, it is the August bank holiday weekend, and if you're among those to have a bit of time off before this terrible storm hits, you may be heading for the hills or to the coast for a walk. Now, it won't obviously cost you a thing. It is great for your health. And there are more routes and trails around the country than ever before. We're going to be talking a bit more about this shortly. But first, unlike countries like Sweden and Finland, where the public has a legal right to roam, access to the Irish countryside depends on the goodwill and cooperation of farmers, landowners and the state. Well, Helen Lawless is Access and Environmental Manager with Mountaineering Ireland, and I caught up with her earlier and I asked her, when it comes to the legal situation, what should people keep in mind when they're heading out to enjoy a walk in the Irish countryside?
I think the first most important thing for people to recognise is that all land in Ireland is owned. Most of that is in private ownership. Less than 20% of our land area is state-owned land. Our privately owned lands, particularly in the hills and countryside, often include areas of commonage in which a number of people have shares. Participants in recreational activities need to be aware that there is no legal right of access for recreation in Ireland's countryside.
It might be quite surprising for people to learn that this also is the case in state-owned property. So I'm thinking of things like Cuailte Forests. Access is permissive here. The public does not have a legal right of access, even in state-owned property.
That's correct. The same applies in our national parks, established primarily for conservation purposes. And while they are generally open to the public, as is Cuailte property, access can be restricted if necessary for conservation or, in Cuailte's case, for operational reasons in the forest.
There is, in general, a lot of goodwill around this issue from farmers and landowners who seem, the vast majority, only too happy to see walkers on their land and to enter schemes that mean that they get a very small amount of money in return for that access. But to be clear, in principle, in legal terms, access in Ireland is permissive. It isn't a right. It could theoretically be stopped if the owner decides they don't want it anymore.
Yes, that's the situation with regard to marked walking routes, like the Western Way or the Wicklow Way. They're permissive routes and the landowners can withdraw their permission. But there's a lot more land that is enjoyed by the public. If you think about coastal lands or hills where people wander, there is no access arrangement in place in most of those areas. But people continue to enjoy them, and that's with the goodwill and the tolerance of the landowners. And that's something that we all need to be really mindful of as we enjoy the outdoors this weekend and every day.
And the proportion of people who enjoy the countryside and go walking in the countryside, it really went up during the COVID pandemic. And we know that access to walking the countryside is, you know, so good for our mental and physical health. We've seen a real burgeoning of the number of walking routes that have been made available, and a lot of public money has gone into that. Can you just describe what the department has done in the last few years to open up new routes?
There has been an expansion of the walk scheme. So that's the scheme under which landowners are paid for maintaining marked routes across their land. There's also been further efforts to improve the availability of access in upland areas with the expansion of the Mountain Access Project. Local authorities and local development companies across the country are being supported to work with local sports partnerships to develop an outdoor recreation plan for each county. And that's fantastic because that means that the vision in the National Outdoor Recreation Strategy is starting to extend to communities right across the country.
One of the things that farmers will often say is that they are concerned about public liability. I remember back in, I think it was 2016,
a circuit court judge decided to award a walker €40,000 for her injuries from a fall along the Wicklow Way. I think it was a rotting boardwalk near Roundwood. And although this happened on state-owned property and a High Court judge overturned that decision, it left farmers and landowners extremely concerned that they could be open to something similar. Can you just outline the current legal situation? So if a farmer or a landowner gives permission for the public to walk their land, how liable are they?
Their responsibility to the public is absolutely minimal, Ella. The law on occupiers' liability changed in 2023. Landowners' duty of care to people coming onto their land is not to deliberately injure them. Reckless disregard would be something as deliberate as digging a hole and concealing it, effectively creating a trap for people. The ethos of personal responsibility, it is now the law. When people go up a hill or they go to explore a cave system or they dive into a lake, the law recognises that that's a risk that they take. And the phrase that's been introduced to our law is voluntary assumption of risk. So that makes the situation for landowners so much clearer than it has been in the past.
One final thing, Helen, is about social media and the drive to get followers being a stimulant for people to take risks really where they shouldn't. And I'm thinking about people going on to the likes of Salty Islands, getting too close to puffins, taking photographs. It'll obviously give them more followers because the photographs are lovely, but it's extremely difficult for nature. How big an issue is this becoming? And how careful do we have to be about the idea that you go to extreme lengths to boost your own followers, but actually at the same time, you're damaging wild areas and you're harming wildlife?
Yes, it's a real dilemma. Social media is a massive driver of outdoor recreation activity. If we share information about those spaces with others, we have to think, what might the consequences of that be? And even if we tell others that we've been careful, we have to recognize that some people are literally just going to go with a dropped pin and they're going to blunder in there and try and recreate that beautiful photograph of a puffin with sand eels in its mouth. And that could be really detrimental to the survival of that species. And farmers certainly do not want to see people coming onto hill land with dogs at all. But we've also got to remember that there's wildlife in those upland areas as well. You won't necessarily see the birds in upland areas. They nest on the ground. Dogs flush the parent bird off the nest. If that happens a number of times in a day, it's unlikely eggs will get hatched or that the chicks will fledge. It is not acceptable that as a consequence of recreational activity. So there is certainly need for greater educational about responsible enjoyment of the countryside, possibly looking at how they identify the most sensitive areas, the places that people really need to keep out of. That's a difficult balance. In a country where people have no right of access, it's difficult to accept further restrictions. But what it comes back to is that enjoyment of Ireland's outdoors is a privilege and it comes with lots of responsibility.
Helen Lawless there from Mountaineering Ireland. And just on that last point, I just saw there yesterday, the National Parks and Wildlife Service have actually decided, coincidentally enough, they've decided to appoint seabird wardens on the Salty Islands because they are so concerned about that point that Helen made about visitors going on, especially during breeding season. So hopefully that'll protect the likes of the puffins and the gannets on the islands. Hopefully now the weather will look up over the next few weeks, especially before the kids go back to school, because there are a lot of very nice new walks available. The walk scheme itself started back in 2008 and it was set up to help open up more of these routes across the country on private land. And the idea of it is pretty simple. Farmers and landowners get public funding and it's from about €500 to the maximum of €2,000 a year. And in return, they allowed the public to access their land and they also helped to maintain the trails. Well, last weekend, you may have seen about 7,000 people climbed Croagh-Patrick for Reek Sunday. But beyond the Reek in Mayo, there's an awful lot to offer when it comes to walking routes, including the Clogher Newtown Forest Trail, which is east of Westport. And the man overseeing it all is Martin Delane, who is the Rural Recreation Officer for Mayo with the Southwest Mayo Development Company. I met up with him during the week in a very busy Westport, and I began by asking him just how well this walk scheme has been received by farmers in his home county.
Oh, well, walks are incredibly busy in Mayo. Currently in Mayo, we have 7 walks on the walk scheme. We have maybe in the region of 500 work plans. We're probably one of the biggest counties, I think second only to County Cork, in terms of partnerships and membership of the walk scheme. So they're very, very popular. We get a lot of foreign visitors who like to do the long distance waymarked ways. That seems to be where their emphasis is. Now, then since COVID, there's been a whole rebirth in people wanting discovering their own towns and villages and what have they available in those areas. So they are really interested in doing the loops and learning about their whole area.
Well, a good example of how the walk scheme works in practice is in the village of Clogher, which is about 25 kilometres east of Westport, where locals meet every Tuesday evening to go for a walk together along a local wood and bog. It's called the Newtown Forest Trail, and it is a cluster of 3 walks which start at an old blacksmith's forge, which is also the community centre.
There's a lovely bog walks down through the bog. Like, we're in the bog, we're not on the road so much, and the scenery is gorgeous.
Stop. Can anyone join?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
It's free.
And there's,
free.
Yeah, there's tea and biscuits afterwards because we deserve those. Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
There's a lovely path down. There's gates and kind of going in and out between the different parts of the bog. You feel very safe and it's really gorgeous.
And nice being away from the cars, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's the social side of it too. Like, we're not in it here now to break records or anything. Like,
we all wait for each other as well.
Yeah.
We don't so you're not just break off.
No.
After some people trailing, we'll sort of hold up and wait for them. And
I can't help but notice there's mainly women here, but there are two men. You're the token men here.
I'd say talk to him now.
No, we enjoy every Tuesday. It's nice to meet all the women. We have no women at home, so we might find them, bring one home. Some might want to talk to us, but we just really know them.
It's nice talking when you don't have to look at people, isn't it? Side by side.
It is, when you can keep moving on, and if they're saying some nonsense, you can just speed up a bit.
It's a beautiful piece of bog down there. It's absolutely gorgeous, and it's full of rare wildlife. Just last week, we found a fly called Tachina grossa. It's about as big as the end of your thumb. Show me your thumb.
Yeah,
it's about that big. It lays its eggs on caterpillars. And when the eggs hatch, the little grubs eat into the caterpillar and eat it from the inside. So the caterpillar grows, and the grubs save the heart and the breathing mechanism and the stomach until the last, save the best till last, because they know the caterpillars need that if they're going to support them through their lives.
Ingenious.
And you'd meet Tachina grossa down there and get to say
and
hello.
How rare is this delightful sounding fly?
Well, this is a first record for this part of the country. They're quite scarce. They're widespread across Europe.
So when you're going on these walks, you're chatting, but you're looking around a lot, I presume.
Yeah, I tend to get left behind looking at flies and flowers.
I better let you go. Thank you so much. Have a great walk. 15 farmers are involved in this cluster of walks. In return for payment, they give access to the public to walk their land and commit to a maintenance plan of picking up litter and checking to make sure the walkways and gates are in good order. Well, one of the farmers is Bernie Kilboyle, who allowed 4 acres of her bog to be included in the walk scheme.
All we had to consider is a small bit of maintenance, cutting the grass, keeping it maintained around our area and doing some litter picking. So I thought the financial reward you were getting for doing that little bit of work, I thought, and I went back to Mother, and she said, well, look at, you know, you're going to take it over next year. It's up to you. So I went with it and I haven't looked back.
Did you have to actually do the walkway across the bog, or was there a path already there?
I have given them permission now to put walkways in my bog, and they're going to do some more activity things in the future.
And why did you decide to do it?
I'd done it because I've seen how successful the other walks were. And also I have children and they like to walk and they utilise the Newtown Forest Walk. I just thought it was a really good addition to the walks that were already established.
They're lovely, Vincent. They're lovely.
Come on.
To get a better view of the bog, Bernie and her neighbour, farmer Vincent Mahon, took me through a field of Vincent's cattle, which looks over the Newtown Forest Trail, with panoramic views of Croke Patrick beyond.
Oh no, come on, you have to come and see them because you're among them anyway. Tell you
what breed do you keep?
Pure Charolais and Limousines and Belgian Blues.
And what are they saying at the mart now with
the
prices?
Oh, I cannot believe it. Cannot believe it. The one thing we're all saying is, will it last? The demand is there for Irish beef. Oh, they're producing good cattle, quality cattle. Mm. And they want them all over the world. Now look at this thing. Oh, they should come to right.
Best stuff around.
Now, we close the gate.
You were probably one of the first farmers to get into purebred farming here.
Here, yeah. So there's purebred farming. Yeah. I have all the females here. And there's a Belgian Blue, great, I'm hoping to have her for the show. Here she is there now. Now, Angelines. I'm not panicking at all. Now, Angelines. Come on. Angels. Come on. It's a matter of just taming them down. And when they get used to nuts, they come out to the road to follow me home. That's often awesome a part of the good point. Yeah, all right. They like the nuts. Now, we'll go up here at the top of the hill and you get a great view of the area. Come on, Bernie, you're all right.
How long have you been farming?
All my life. My mother had the place before me, and my father used to work in England. There was nothing that time. He used to go over to England working. Didn't have money to keep it going here. £20 a fortnight, I remember, coming around.
Was he working on the building
sites?
He
was working on the buildings and on the motorways and Spaghetti Junction and all those places in England. The few pounds was welcome when he came home. You know, it was good to us really now, you know. And
so what about all these walkers everywhere?
I don't know, no. It's just good for the area. Even from COVID now, you see a lot of people walking around here. Yeah. It's just quiet, you know. And it's good for people to get out from the town or get out. Come on, guys. Come on. Sunday morning, the view here and the reek in the background was fantastic.
So we could see Croke Patrick from here?
This cloud is down on it. They are the Parthenry Mountains up there. And they go down into Turmacady.
And this is the bog in front of us?
This is the bog. Yeah.
And that's where the walk is?
That's where the walk
is. Tree walk.
Yeah.
So all the walkers that you meet, they're from everywhere, are they?
They're everywhere, yeah. I met a woman back the last year. She came in from, where did you go? France or someplace, I think it was. Good English. She was nice to talk to, you know.
Yeah, because you can spend a lot of time on your own as a farmer.
Yes, that's right, yeah. It's nice to meet people.
You can meet anyone. Actually, I met an American guy just passing by our house and I was at the gate and we had a great chat. I said, you're on the right way. He was going to Ballintubber Abbey. He was just loving nature. He loves the wildflowers. He loved the ruggedness of it. He just loved the peace and quiet. And he had travelled all the way through the Croke Patrick Heritage Trail.
And it feels like it's going to be a real part of the future of rural Ireland in places like this. Walking routes that are free to use, but then spin off sort of local economy on the back of it, like coffee shops or whatever.
Yeah, and we're in the middle of doing community futures here in Clogher, and that is one thing that came up. They're on about a coffee shop.
What's community futures?
Community futures is a scheme that we were doing to find out what the people in the community want, what they want in the future for the next 5 years, like a blueprint. We have our own walk in Newtown now, which we never thought we'd have in our village. Our own walk that's safe for children, safe for families, safe for anyone. And yeah, I really recommend it. We've had no issues so far, only positivity, and I suppose I think it's very positive.
Bernie Kilboyle and Vincent Mahon there, and my thanks to the walking group in Clogher too. They meet every Tuesday at 7 o'clock if anyone's interested over there in Mayo. And also, if anyone is interested, there is a very helpful new site where you can find Ireland's walking trails all in one place. You just put in your county, what kind of trail you're looking for and your ideal distance, and it'll give you the nearest route. And that site is sportireland.ie/outdoors/find-your-trails. sportireland.ie/outdoors/find-your-trails. We're on 51551 for texts and we're back after these.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Well, you might well recognise that sound, the call of the male corncrake. It is a sound that has become all too rare across most of Ireland, as we've reported many times here on the programme. And the reason, well, at its heart, the corncrake really belongs to an Ireland of the past, the 1950s, when small mixed farms, hay meadows and wetlands were common. Back then, farming was low intensity and the landscape was a lot more diverse. But for corncrakes today, Ireland is a hostile place. And that includes areas like the Shannon Callows, which were once a heartland for the species. Corncrake haven't been heard there since 2014. Well, in response to the threat of their extinction here, just under €6 million of public money was allocated a few years ago for a four-year project aimed at helping them, particularly along the northwest coastal counties. Well, that project wraps up this year, and one of the places involved is Inishbofin off the coast of Galway. Suzanne Campbell travelled out to the island to see how the corncrake is getting on, and she met first with farmer Pat Coyne.
I would have been involved in cotton creek conservation probably for 30 years. There was a guy that used to come out here in the old days from the MPW, a guy called Tim Gordon, and he kind of regenerated them. And we got them up to about 10 or 11. And it was great, like, but you couldn't improve it on that. And then subsequent to that, they got the Life Project in, and that's been going for the last 5 years. The main things in relation to the corn creek, really, what we have to do is, number one, once you get a chance, 1st of March, you let your field go. But previous to that, say the October, November, you make sure the field is well grazed so that good, clear vegetation comes up again. And as a result of that, the bird likes that and moves through it. And that's why we have to let it go, say, from the 4th of March. So by the time they come back in late April, there's ground there and cover for them, which is very important.
Okay.
And at that stage, then they start to shout, and hopefully then a week or two they mate, and then usually they move on again and do a second mating.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So when I've been here before earlier in the year and they are calling, that's to call a mate or define a territory, is it?
It is both, yeah. They want their own territory, and where they call from is never the place they actually nest. So they need someplace very safe to nest, and it's usually quite a distance away from that, maybe 100, 150 metres. And then if everything goes according to plan, when they have the first nest out, they move on and they go to a different location. Like, the great thing this year now, it looks like there was probably 14 birds in Inishbofin, especially in May, early season, there was a lot of them. Inishturk, down next door neighbours, there's about 7. And in Inishark Island, it looks like 5. So even though Boffin would be the stronghold, I suppose it's maximises the amount of birds, and then they can go on the close hinterland, and it makes a great difference as well. So as a result of that, you have mid-20s this year of corncrakes in this locality.
So the ones in Boffin, almost all the territories that they want are taken up. So their offspring, when they come back, they might be going to Turk or in Shark.
And that's the feeling that people have, or the people in the know, the experts. They think that they will migrate out further as the next generation come back, and that's a good sign, you know.
So here, is this one of the territories here, or where?
It is, yeah, it's just on the graveyard now there. And you can see that field now is nicely balanced, growing. Every July, there's the actual team from the Corn Creek Project come out and they score it. And this field here actually got a 10, so it couldn't be any better. It's a perfect location for them. Probably the best natural habitation for the Corn Creek is the nettle.
Really?
Yeah, because it grows up and it covers an area.
Yeah.
And underneath that, there's a lot of bugs that live there, and there's a lot of space to move around freely, you know?
Yeah, so they need it open on the understory.
They do,
The lower part.
Yeah, they don't need it too thick. If it's too thick, the grass, they can't move through it and they move on right away, you know?
Okay, so there's so many factors that need to be right.
But that's why it's very important that it's grazed and it's ready to go 1st of March. So, like, the first crop should be in place, nested by late May at the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
And then that means they can have another crop in July. As a rule, most people could silage in July or August, but out here now we wouldn't do it until late September, because it gives them a chance to get ready to migrate again back to Africa.
Yeah. And for you and tourism, we can start probably walking back
yeah.
now. For you, because you own a hotel, the Dolphin, like a lot of the people who come to Boffin, I presume are very interested in the Corncrake project and the conservation.
Oh, especially interested in the Corncrake. Like, we would do 3 bird watching tours, in 2 in May and 1 in June. And the priority bird for everyone to see and hear is the Corncrake. And as a result of that, it's great for tourism, it's great for biodiversity, and it means a lot more people are interested to come back, and they say, I haven't heard the Corncrake in 30, 40 years when we were young. Especially a lot from the Midlands now that have come down in the last generation. They'd hear their parents speaking about it, and a lot of their parents would come back as well to try to hear it. So it's reminiscent, and it's a kind of something that people found very special, yet very annoying when they were 40 years ago, because they shout all night, you know.
They are loud, aren't they, when they're in their full tune?
There's only 2 actually shouting at the moment every night, one in the east end of the island and one back in Fawnmore.
Okay, I've tried to find both, by the way, and they won't talk to me.
The big worry now we'd have going forward is the LIFE project is finished this year, and what's going to happen in 2026. And the big fear is that it's going to be linked into acres. Any farmer that's doing this is doing it for the love of farming and the love of nature, not pure economics, but it helps at the same time, you know?
Yeah, of course, because you can't put stock in those fields.
From the first, I would have 6 hectares now that there'll be no stocking from the 1st of March until the 1st of October. And the funny thing about the Corncrake, he loves the good land as well.
They are discerning.
Very discerning, yeah. They have no time for the rushes, yeah.
Okay.
They're not up to speed with them, you know. The main thing is you enjoy the rest of your day here.
Well, I'm very lucky to be here, there's no place like it.
Even in the rain,
that's it. Thanks for talking to me, Pat.
Take it easy and enjoy the madness.
Lovely stuff there from farmer Pat Coyne talking to Suzanne Campbell. Well, the manager of that Corncrake Life project is John Carey, and I'm delighted to say he's with us this morning. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Ella.
John, for a bird that is so rare in Ireland, one that the vast majority of us will never see and never hear, it's a huge amount of money that was dedicated, just under 6 million euro for a 4-year project. Presumably without these intense efforts, the Corncrake would have gone all but extinct by now. Why do you think it's important that these efforts continue and so much money is poured into saving this species?
I guess when we started thinking about having a life project for Corncrake back in 2018, the population of the birds nationally was down to about 168, which is just incredibly low. And they'd been in that kind of population range for many years. So they really weren't increasing in number. The efforts to save the Corncrake were really only perhaps prolonging its decline and slowing it down. So with the advent of a lot of results-based agri-environmental schemes in particular, in Ireland, where we have great examples of agri-environmental schemes that are results-focused, we've seen success for conservation and farmers. So by trying to use available European resources to develop an agri-environmental program for Corncrake, the idea was that by doing that, we can work more closely with farmers, more action and results-orientated, to improve the situation for these birds.
And I know you're still crunching the data. At the start of the project, so it was 2022 to 2026, at the start of the project, you wanted to increase, your aim was an increase of the breeding population by 20% compared to 2018, when it was, as you say, 150 calling males. Do you expect to achieve that?
Oh yeah, well, we actually achieved that within year 3 of the project. We had already achieved a 35% increase. So the results of our approach to this were really happened really quickly. So we knew if we did it right that the birds would respond to us reasonably quick, because corncrakes are quite short lived. They only live for about 2 or 3 years in the wild. So if you can work with them intensively for a short period of time, you can grow the population reasonably quick. So like within year 3 of the project, we'd already increased the population by 35%. So we exceeded our target. But you don't rest on your laurels then. That is the basis then for growth, to try and get this population up again to a more sustainable level. And last year we had 233 calling male corncrake territories in Ireland, which was the highest in 25 years. So we knew the approach of the Life Project and indeed the MPWS Corncrake programme, which all worked together, that this multifaceted approach was working.
And
we were seeing...
Yeah, everything is about the male call, isn't it? And I just wanted to play, and we might just have a quick listen here, to the female call, because she does call too. Have a listen to this. It's much less rasping, isn't it, John?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's that same disyllabic call, but it's extremely rare to hear the call of a female corncrake. And scientists still are unsure why that bird calls, why the female bird calls. But we suspect she calls if there's no males around and she's in good habitat and she's trying to figure out why is there no potential partner here. So generally, when we hear that call during our survey work, it's not actually a great sign. It means that we've got a female bird here who has found good habitat, but there's actually no male bird to partner with her.
No male bird around. Are there any new locations that it's been heard this season around Ireland?
Yeah, we are still crunching the data, as you said, but we have had birds again in the Dingle Peninsula in County Kerry, which is very positive. We also had a bird for the first time in many, many years in West Cork, in the Mizzen Peninsula, and we had a bird in Waterford near Kilmacthomas, which is probably 30 years since there was a bird in County Waterford.
That is particularly extraordinary, isn't it? Because your project is very much focused on the north and the northwest counties. And I was going to ask whether have you all but given up on the south and the southeast of the country? Of course, they used to be there, but haven't been in a long while.
But with the nature of corncrakes, they tend to return to within 5 or 10 kilometres of where they were born. So their range expansion can be very, very slow. But when you do get a larger population increase, like we've seen in the past 5 years, occasionally you'll get nomadic birds or even small groups of nomadic birds, because they probably migrate in groups that basically, you know, these are extra new birds to the system. And they might just find themselves a little bit off course and in new areas. But if the habitat seems suitable to them, they'll have a go at breeding. And that's really interesting because, for example, in County Kerry now, we've seen birds arrive there for the last 4 or 5 seasons, which is indicative, because they're short-lived, that they have successfully bred. And now there's a small population of birds that are kind of hardwired to go back to that area.
So you need to keep going with that and make sure they continue to do that.
Absolutely.
I just wonder, John, I mean, you've been living and breathing corncrakes for the last 4 years. When was the first time you heard one?
Interestingly enough, it was in my home county of Sligo, and it was back probably in 2017. When I was working as a ranger with the National Parks, I got a call that there was a corncrake in West Sligo, and would I just go out and check it out. And I was familiar with the bird's call, of course, but I'd never heard one in real life. So this isn't long ago. I'm a corncrake blow-in. but I can vividly remember standing with a young farmer on the side of the road, and he was telling me where he thought the bird was, and then it just started calling. And it was remarkable, really.
It is quite the thing. I've heard it myself, yeah. And it is quite remarkable to hear it in real time. And just finally, with the project now finishing, what is going to happen to this conservation work in the future?
Well, look, the good news is that, you know, during the last 5 years, we've developed really strong actions that we know work. And all of those actions have been now adapted into the Acres Cooperation Project. So those actions are available through Acres as a landscape action for all of our farmers who are involved in life. And we're now busy transferring a lot of them across to the Acres program. But sitting complementary to that, the National Parks and Wildlife Service has committed to mainstreaming the actions of corncrake life. So we're working on the framework for that at the moment and how it'll look. But going forward, there's going to be action for corncrake in the long run. And because what we don't want is any backsliding on how well we've done to increase this population. And I mean, for the future, we would like to not just see corncrakes in their core areas on the West Coast. We'd like to see them far more widespread and even returning, hopefully, to places like the Shannon Callows, which
would be
a
huge success if they did, because as I said, they haven't been there for 10 years. Just in 10 seconds, do you feel optimistic about the future?
Absolutely. I mean, we started with such a small number of birds, and what's been achieved with everyone involved, farmers, conservationists, everything is just remarkable. So they're going in the right direction, but they have a bit to go yet, mm-hmm. Ella.
OK, well, listen, John Carey, thank you very much. We'll keep an eye out for that report, which should be published in the next few weeks. Well, we're going to swing now to the international, because it was all smiles and handshakes last Sunday when the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, and US President Donald Trump announced a trade agreement with an agreed 15% maximum tariff on EU goods exported to the US. Now, few would rejoice at that rate, which is much higher than the pre-Trump levels of around 4.8% on average. But the finalising of the deal at least brings a degree of certainty to what has been a pretty chaotic and unstable few months. Over 4.2 billion euro of goods and services cross the Atlantic every day between the EU and the US. And included in that, of course, are Irish butter, cheese and whiskey, amongst others. So for more on what this means for Irish agricultural exports, I'm joined now by Lorcan Roach Kelly from the Irish Farmers Journal. Good morning, Lorcan.
Good morning.
There are a lot of variables at play, but just a general point first. We saw the global markets tumbling yesterday as the latest wave of tariff announcements came. Canada hit by 35%, Brazil 50%, 25% for India, 39% for Switzerland. And in that context, and we're really grasping for any kind of silver lining here, is it fair to say that the EU's rate of 15% seems to be reasonably good in comparison?
Thanks for having me on, Ellie. I think there's a few things that are kind of important, a few of the details are important on this. First thing to say is that the details we have are somewhat sketchy at the mm-hmm. moment. Details are a bit like corncrakes. We can't get them when we need them. But the I think the 15% rate that Europe got is a much better deal once you look under the bonnet than it seems to be on the surface, because the 15% rate for Europe got is an all-in rate. And that's really important, because there's traditionally been a lot of tariffs on goods crossing the Atlantic, on all global trade under the World Organization rules have been there since the 70s. There's been lots of tariffs in place. So when Donald Trump announced a 10% tariff or a 20% tariff or a 30% tariff, that tariff is an additional tariff, which means the ones you paid for years plus an extra 10 or 15 or 20%. What the EU has managed to do is get the 15% tariff to be an all-in tariff. So if you're paying the traditional tariff rate, you might not have to pay very much extra at all. And particularly in the case of butter, you might be paying nothing extra at all, because the tariff rate that has existed is close to 15% anyway. So when you look at the rate Ireland got, or EU got versus, say, the UK, UK tariff is a 10% tariff, but it's additional. But UK is also paying the traditional WTO tariffs. So the UK butter could be going over at 25% and Irish butter could be going over at 15%.
And it
so
does,
it's the
butter
are really important in this.
I mean, that's a really important point, because we operate on an all-Ireland basis. And so you're looking at a much higher rate in Northern Ireland than here. We're looking at two tariffs then, potentially, on the island of Ireland. And I saw yesterday Damien MacDonald, who's the DG of the Irish Farmers Association, said this could bring a huge administrative burden into play, because the dairy industry operates on integrated supply chains cross-border. So what is how is that going to play out?
Well, I think he's completely right. Like the rules of origin rules, basically. So you have to say what you're producing and where it came from. And if you're driving a dairy truck for Lakeland or Tyrone or one of the cross-border co-ops, you're not particularly saying this is Republic of Ireland milk, this is Northern Ireland milk. There's lots of it'll be a lot of paperwork for someone to work out. It can be worked around, but it would be much easier. And we saw this with the Brexit negotiations went on for years. The idea was to have an all-island tariff rate for everything, because it just makes the cross-border trade much easier, and having any kind of border in Ireland is something that nobody wants at the moment. So I think it'll be worked out, but there will be the kind of, I suppose, ways around it, but it'll be much more complex and lead to lots of paperwork and lots of maybe little frictions in trade that don't need to be there.
And just finally, about beef, exports to America from Ireland are worth, I think, around 10 million euros. It's not a huge amount. But we do need to keep an eye on the cascading impact of other tariffs here, don't we? Because I know his 50% tariff on Brazil means that they may start looking for other markets. They may push Australian beef out of the Chinese market. It's a bit like falling dominoes. So Australian beef might soon be making its way to Britain. That is a big market for us. So it's going to be a very important one to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I think you're completely right. If you look at like Irish beef exports to the UK were 150 times larger than Irish beef exports to US. US is not a major market. There's lots of reasons for that, the historical reasons down the years. But I don't least them that fact that the EU won't let US beef into the EU because of the hormone issue there. But you're completely right. If the Brazilian beef is one of the cheapest beefs in the world, it's about half the price of Irish beef. Donald Trump is putting in tariffs on that, so there were 250,000 tons of beef would probably need a new home. As you said, that might push into China, and that'll push Australian meat out of China, which will come into Europe. The EU right now is looking to do a trade deal with Australia. We also have the Mercosur, that's the EU-South America trade deal. It's going to be ratified fairly soon. So I think of the market, I suppose Donald Trump has caused a lot of market disruption, but the one for the Irish agriculture to keep an eye on, particularly is the beef market. Because see how the flows end up there. We're going to see probably a year or 18 months of quite choppy trade as people open new markets and give up on old ones.
Okay, well, there's a lot to keep an eye on. Lorcan Roach-Kelly of the Irish Farmers Journal, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We're going to end with something rather lovely because it started back in 1864 as a way to revitalise Irish horse breeding, and it's now Ireland's largest equestrian event. The Dublin Horse Show begins next Wednesday in the RDS, and included in the classes will be the donkey. Donkeys are not native to Ireland but were brought here from the Middle East and North Africa in the 17th century, but they proved to be an Irish farmer's best friend, a real workhorse on the farm. About a century ago, there were 250,000 of them on farms across the country, and today that's dwindled to in and around 10,000. But the Irish Donkey Society is doing their best to continue to support them. Well, a few weeks ago, two foals were born on club member Donal Staunton's farm in Clifton in Galway. Lorna Siggins went along to see them and was joined by donkey enthusiast Chloe Heenu and Donal's son, Donny.
Oh, aren't they lovely?
Mammy has the marks too on the legs.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
She's got them. So this one, we don't know whether she's going to have a foal or not. The one we're looking at there is a 16-year-old one with the foal. That's Falkira Molly.
So this is Falkira Molly, yeah.
And her daughter is the black one, Sky Road Lady Luck. And she had the baby foal first, and then her mother here had the other foal.
Okay.
So they're mother and daughter, and then they both had two fillies. So that's Margot, and the other one is Edith. Two little girls.
Two little girls.
How is Donny?
Lovely. Come here. Oh, you're very shy.
They're only 6 days old, so they'll get livelier and livelier. The next time now, they'll be running around together.
Okay. The legs are so long, aren't they?
They say that when they're born, that their legs are nearly, if they're adult, then it's only their body that has to grow. Or that's
really?
What they say anyway.
Wow. And the ears look fully grown, don't they?
She's
big
got
enough.
Massive ears.
Look at her.
Yeah.
She's picking up radio too, that one.
So I didn't realise how long they're pregnant for.
It can be up to 14 months, yeah. Now, these were about 12 and a half, 13, I think, but I had no exact date. She's coming again.
So funny, like, they just start copying their mother at some stage. Like, they've no teeth right now. See the way she's mimicking the mother grazing.
Oh, I see. But yeah. can she actually get the grass?
She's just gum, like, she's no teeth.
So when will the teeth come?
Should be in the next few months, even the next month and a half, I'd say. They'll start breaking through. They'll be chewing on everything and biting them.
Now, isn't she lovely, Donny?
Mm-hmm. They're dying to come over and have a look, but they're just not sure. They're not brave enough yet.
Yeah. So, Donny, what do they like to eat best?
Toast.
Anything else? Any vegetables?
Yeah.
Carrots? No?
They don't eat carrots.
They do eat carrots. The man that owned these donkeys, Henry Brown, and his brother Mickey used to bring the turf in from the hill with them. So their mothers worked. These didn't really, they were just pets. He has all the gear in the shed up there, the baskets and the creel and all that.
And the cart and all
right,
that.
Okay.
And what they used to do is Henry might have two or three and the neighbour would have two, but when they'd go turf, they'd borrow two, so they could end up with six of them all going together. So that's how they used to do it, because that was before quads and tractors. And
yeah.
In the end, people stopped doing the turf.
Yeah.
It was easier to buy a tractor or turf than... and do it.
Yeah.
But they'd keep the donkey all year long for 2 weeks' work, like.
Yeah.
So.
For 2 weeks' work. And I suppose good for keeping the nettles down.
Yeah, they do. They eat all the buttercup. I tend to put them into the field after the cows have finished, and they eat all the last grass that remains. So,
so with the restrictions on turf cutting, how has that affected donkeys? Because is there less need for them now?
I know this village that used to use them, there hasn't been a sod of turf brought in 25 years on a donkey, I'd
say. Same as that.
They just wouldn't...
So nobody uses them on the bog now?
No.
Now, we could be totally wrong, and Connemara, there might be somebody, but it's kind of a tradition that has died out. But
interestingly, I was in the park there at the weekend, and there was a man that came up to me, and he got this sort of contract building kind of a trail up through this special area conservation, SAC in Connemara, and he was saying the crowd who got the contract with, he said they probably wouldn't be inclined to let me use a tractor or a quad, and he was wondering, would I break in one of my donkeys to carry up the stuff from in through the woods to this place? So there's an odd few little bits like that come about, but as Donal was saying, it's not sort of an annual regular thing that you'd see people bringing turf in.
Because I don't know donkey numbers. Chloe probably know more. Are they up or down?
I think in Ireland at the moment there's only around, is there around 7,000? We'll say back in the 50s, 60s, 70s when they were in work, there was over 250,000 of them. So there's been a huge drop, as Donal was saying earlier, since the tractor came in. Do you know, that was nearly the beginning of the end for the donkey, really, in agriculture, you know.
These aren't worth a lot at all.
Really?
No, yeah,
like you could get anywhere between about 200 and 500 for a mare, and then a foot, like a jack that's not castrated, you'd be lucky to get maybe €50. Sometimes if you have them gelded, they could be a companion for a mare or something, because donkeys always have to come in pairs. They're very social animals.
You'll notice
if you ever see a donkey in the field by himself, he's always hovering the fence looking for a passerby that might take pity on him or calling out for another one. So it's lovely what Donal has here. Like, there's three of them, and they're
so they
friends,
get, they get
know?
Lonely.
They would,
they do, yeah.
You've three donkeys.
I do, yeah.
And one of them I saw jumping.
Yeah.
I didn't know the donkeys jumped.
Yeah, because I asked for a pony when I was about 7, and nobody in our family was into ponies, and my granddad's cousin had two donkeys that he didn't want anymore, so we got them in exchange for a load of turf back in the day, and I just started breaking in the donkeys and making use of what I had. And it was a mother and a daughter that I got, and the daughter had a foal since, so I have a third generation donkey, so she's very special, and taught her to jump as well. And it's a great way of keeping them fit, and I lunge them and all of that over poles and things, and they enjoy it, and they go out for their little walks and
Is that a bit unusual?
I think it is. I've seen videos of people jumping cows and other stuff, but donkeys is a new one, I think, anyway.
But do you feel they enjoy it?
I think they do, yeah. They like a little challenge, and they're very intelligent animals. They're quite easy to train, even though some people mightn't believe it, but the donkey does like to think about things before he takes action. A lot of people take it up as stubbornness, but the donkey will stand there and he'll think of his options for a few minutes before he takes action. And
they're misunderstood animals.
They are.
So you're both involved in the Irish Donkey Society.
We were founded in the 1970s by Lady Anne from Swinfen. So it was around the time that, you know, the tractors started coming in and the donkeys started becoming less. So just a group of donkey enthusiasts. We love donkeys and we just want to show everyone how great they are. We don't provide sanctuary as such, but we often have people coming to us wondering, you know, I'm thinking of buying a donkey, what do I need to do? Or I got a donkey, how do I get it microchipped? And, you know, we're always happy to help people with queries and things like that. And we have two events every year. We go up to Mullingar Show, and then we have the RDS Dublin Horse Show on Sunday the 10th of August. So there is carriage driving in the main Grand Prix arena at about 2:30, so we get to bring a few donkeys and carts in there, and it's lovely to go around with all the horses. It's always a good bit of fun. That's usually about 2:30 in the day, and then we have our own display in Ring 1 at about 5:30, and again we'll have creels, turf, we might have turn-up sowers, we could have anything going on in there. So it's always a great day out and we have great fun.
14 months pregnant. God love female donkeys. That's Lorna Siggins there with Donal, his young son Donny and Chloe. And for more information, you can go to donkeysociety.ie. Now, next week, Countrywide will be live from the horse show. Mane's flying in the wind with Brenda Donoghue in the saddle. Eileen Heron produced. Amandine Passant-Devine is our broadcast coordinator. James Feeney is on sound. Until I speak to you again, have a great weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.